This is the seventh and final sequential interview with Jesse Haver Butler, interview Roman numeral 6 on February 14th, 1973. The interview begins with Jesse discussing the launching of her career in Washington, in which she describes the large meeting where Eleanor Roosevelt introduced her first major series of classes. She proceeds to discuss her classes then and some of the women who were in her classes, who later ran for Congress and who became involved in other activities. She relates her decision to write her book and describes the summer that she spent at their hideaway in the Shenandoah Mountains writing the book. Following its publication, she began to relate to the General Federation of Women's Clubs and offered to do workshops for them at their conventions. She used the book at the conventions, and this apparently largely accounted for the success of the book. Her purpose was to train women for leadership positions, and she saw the General Federation of Women's Clubs as being one of the major training grounds. In 1950, she and her husband moved to California, and this meant the dissolution of both their careers. The move was made as a result of health problems that he had. There were severe problems in attempting to reestablish her career here and in trying to get classes at various colleges, but she ultimately gave up and entered an entirely new era which focused primarily on health and involvement of Victanis and on a new religion she found. The last part of the tape describes her recent involvement in the feminist movement, her attitudes about the current movement, Betty Friedan, the goals of the movement, and that this is a revolution.
In our last discussion, we had reached the point where the three women answered the 2,000 cards that were sent out for the class. And when I arrived there, somewhat shaken by the answer to my cards in this city where speaking was the principal occupation of everybody, well, we decided we'd just have the class anyway. And so we did. Took the whole 8 lessons. Two of the women were presidents of clubs in Washington, and the other one was the wife of the vice chairman of the House of Representatives, and a congressman's wife. And she said this was the greatest experience she had had since she'd been the many years in Washington, and wouldn't it be a good idea when we started the class next year to invite Mrs. Roosevelt to come and open the class. Of course, the answer was from me that it would be wonderful, but she would have to write the letter because, as a professional, I couldn't ask Mrs. Roosevelt to do that. So she said she would. She'd write the letter to Mrs. Roosevelt and ask her, in due order, to come the next year and open our class. So the following January, when the Congress was assembling again, we got the very large auditorium in this huge church up on 16th Street, because I had a suspicion that if Mrs. Roosevelt were to be the opening speaker, as in all other times when she spoke, we'd have a crowd there. So we engaged this very large and beautiful auditorium at the rear of this Unitarian church. And then I called up all the private schools there in Washington where girls had come, students had come from all over America to get this Washington experience, and I thought it would be fun for them to be in the gallery and see the wife of the president as she opened the meeting.
What year was this, Jesse?
This was in 1939. Okay. And the girls all came. The gallery upstairs was full there. There were chins hooked over the edge of the railing waiting for Mrs. Roosevelt to arrive. And she had written to this chairman. And so Naturally, I gave her some private lessons on her part as the chairman of the meeting, who was to open, was to introduce the wife of the president. And her husband apparently was very nervous about this, because never before had a congressman's wife introduced the wife of the president. And although she belonged to a different party from this chairman, still it was considered a great honor. So he brought his wife over to my home several times for several private lessons. And we went over the whole program with very great care, I thought, and great attention to detail. And finally, the day arrived, and when we got down to the church there, this auditorium was jammed with congressmen's wives, Senate wives, congressmen's wives, House and Senate, diplomats' wives, and prominent people from all over Washington. It was just filled. There was a very high platform at the end of the room for speakers, but we decided not to use that platform because it was so high and cold up there. And so we got a little small platform put in front of the high platform, sort of a, well, I don't know what you'd call it, but anyway, it was just a small platform, and it had on it a handsome mahogany table and two high-back chairs there, one for the guest of honor and one for the chairman of the meeting. Everything was in perfect order. Pretty soon, the president's wife arrived in her limousine, followed by the Secret Service, and the hostess of the day had a beautiful corsage for her guest of honor, whereupon Mrs. Roosevelt said, well, let's go on with the meeting. In those days, she really worked fast and hard, and in order to get into the room, they had to go through a large door at the end of the room and down then along the side of the room and then curve around up to the small platform where the table and the two chairs were. And I followed them, and as I got to the door, I saw that Mrs. Roosevelt, who was over 6 feet tall, was galloping down that area, and her chairman, who was just 5 feet two, was running to keep up with her. And when they got down to the front of the hall and turned left, Mrs. Roosevelt took her proper seat there. And her chairman, instead of sitting down and getting her breath and getting her glasses out and her notes and so forth, she walked right up to the table and started to introduce her speaker. Evidently, I thought, of course, she'd know enough to sit down a few moments and get calmed and let the speaker get calmed and so forth. So I had never taught anyone to do that. And on this occasion, she walked right up to the table, opened her mouth to introduce her speaker, and no sound came forth. She was completely winded. And then she forgot her introduction, what she was to say, and there was her purse on the table with the notes in it and her glasses. So with a look of horror on her face, she stopped and to open up the purse and get her notes and get her glasses. And what do you think happened? Everything inside the purse rolled out onto the floor. And the next thing I knew, the wife of the President of the United States and her chairman were down on the floor gathering up the contents of the purse. I was seated over on the other side of the hall with the newspaper people. And you have to remember, this was the opening of my career of Washington. And you know what I did? I fainted. I passed out. I couldn't take it. The situation was just unbearable. People who saw me said that my mouth didn't open up and I didn't look unconscious and I didn't faint, but I lost consciousness for quite a little while, filled with horror at this situation. But when I came to, the purse was now holding all its contents properly, and the introduction of the president's wife was being carried on. And it was an exceedingly good introduction. The further part of the program was carried out, what the next lesson was, what the textbook was, and so on. And evidently, my career was not ruined, because the following week, 48 eager students appeared in the small room upstairs for the first class in Washington, because the president's wife had told them all to go and learn to speak so that when they went back home or back to their countries where they came from, they could tell them what was going on in Washington and all about it. It was, of course, like Mrs. Roosevelt, a very practical, simple, sensible speech, the kind of speeches she always made. But you have to feel sorry for me when I tell you that every time I went downtown on F Street, which is a big shopping street in Washington, for months, invariably, I'd look down the street and here was someone who'd spotted me, whom I didn't know, with a big grin on their faces, and invariably they'd stop and say to me, "Wasn't that funny, that public speaking class, when the president's wife helped the chairman fill up her pocketbook with her things?" And I would have to smile grimly and say, "Yes, wasn't it funny?" And I knew it was going to take quite a while to live down the experience, which had to be done. But anyway, the class was a great success. We developed some brilliant speakers out of that class, and they did what Mrs. Roosevelt told them to do. For instance, they were down Iowa, a little town in Iowa, and she was just a typical small-town Midwest wife of a congressman, but she happened to be a shrewd politician. And so she began to gather together a scrapbook of all the things that were going on in Washington and put them in her scrapbook. And then when she went home, she did a tour of the state for the women's clubs called Chit Chats on Washington. And she came to Washington wearing very typical plain clothing from that area. But in Washington, she learned to get different kinds of clothing for her speeches. She put most of her pretty dresses, and then she got home, back in the closet so the girls wouldn't be jealous. But in the end, every year for a long time, she covered the state with these chit-chats on Washington, and the women voters said, "Be sure and vote for Congressman LeCount so we can go on getting those good speeches from his wife." But she did have one sad accident that upset her terribly. One day she was sitting in the gallery of the house where the wives sat, and Drew Pearson was sitting back up, newspaper man who had, I don't know how many thousands of papers copied his news from Washington. And he was sitting back of her, talking to the friend he was with, when she turned around and explained to him that his report he was making to his friend was all wrong. And she knew, because her husband was on the Rules Committee of the House, and she knew he was mistaken. He was somewhat dashed by this bravery on her part, and it was the kind of bravery I doubt if she would have ever done before she had speech lessons. But anyway, to her horror, in Drew Pearson's column the next day, he said he's slowly finding out that he has to be careful on his conversation in the gallery of the House of Representatives, because he said Mrs. Carl LeCount was sitting in front of him and didn't like what he was saying and rose up and hit him over the head with her umbrella. Of course, so that night I had this frantic call from Mrs. LeCount, and she thought her career was ruined and her husband's as well. But I pointed out to her that it was a blessing in disguise, because now the whole country knew her husband was in the Rules Committee of the House, when maybe a lot of them had never heard of him before. And so anyway, she had to learn the lesson that that sort of thing had to be lived down. And of course, she hadn't hit, she explained to me, "You know I wouldn't hit Drew Pearson over the head with my umbrella." And I said, "Yeah, most everybody knows that." But what he was doing was trying to discourage women from taking speech lessons and talking. He was one of those men that didn't want them to do any talking. So that was one of the interesting things that kept happening. Another thing that happened was that after a few years, whenever any wonderful hostess in Washington was giving a big dinner party and always wanted prominent men there, like important legislators or diplomats, they began saying to her, "Well, I'll come to your dinner if you'll be sure and put next to me a woman who's had one of these speech classes," because they seem to be the best conversationalists, and if I don't have somebody like that, I'm likely to be bored all through the dinner sitting next to someone who doesn't know how to converse. So we felt that gradually the tone of conversation and communication in Washington was climbing up to a higher level than it ever had done before. Mrs. Roosevelt came to our classes 2 years after that. And the last time she said, "Well, what shall I talk about now? I've been here so many times. And I don't know what more I can say," when the suggestion was made that she would explain to the women how she handled adverse criticism, which they were sure to get in their public life, and every woman would. And so she went into great detail on what to do whenever they got adverse criticism. And of course, always, she was very, very valuable. And as a result, my gratitude to her for really, literally putting me on the map in Washington, as she did, never ended.
So this really launched your career.
And it launched my career.
Now, what would you do? Would you give classes continuously? When 1 8-week class was over, did you begin another one, or did you just give them every so often?
Well, then all kinds of people began asking for classes. The Democratic women have a beautiful Women's Democratic Club in Washington, large and beautiful. But I think before that, I started in putting on classes at the Congressional Club, where the wives of Congress, of the House and Senate, were members. And that was one of the greatest experiences of my life, and one where I learned some very great lessons about women. Those women ran that congressional club with great skill. It was in a beautiful building, and they had huge lunches. But the first thing they asked me to do was to go there and give a speech on my experience of being presented at the Court of St. James. We called the subject "The Pomp and Pageantry at the Court of St. James." And I had given that talk in New England for many years, so I was well equipped to give it. And I gave it at the Congressional Club, and at that time, the announcement was made that we were starting a public speaking class there. And I think, I looked over my records the other day, that I had classes there for three or four years. And they were very fruitful classes. Very brilliant women came into those classes and very soon began to be powers politically in their states, where they helped their husbands carry on their campaigns. I remember one woman from Arizona, and she was a college woman, but she had never done much speaking. But the next year, after she had that class, she went out and covered the state with speeches and was able to describe the complicated issues that her husband endorsed when he was in the House of Representatives. And he was a very fine, experienced lawmaker. So that she just covered the state and helped him very much, speaking to clubs that he couldn't address. The women's clubs would take a congressman's wife. All the women's clubs do not stand for any particular party. They're not partisan politicians. But they would take the wife there where they wouldn't get the husband, because he was a party man.
Now, were any of the women themselves in Congress or in their state legislatures, or was it almost always the wives of politicians?
Well, at first they were the wives of politicians, but then after quite a number of years, and just before we left Washington, Mrs. Eleanor Sullivan turned up from St. Louis, Missouri, the wife of a new congressman, and took the class the minute she arrived in Washington. But she was very disturbed because she was in a class with a number of the Dutch wives who had gone through imprisonment in the East during World War II. And they had some terrible stories to tell of their imprisonment in the Japanese camps out there. So Mrs. Sullivan used to come to me afterwards and say, "I haven't anything to talk about." She was so carried away with these stories that these Dutch women were telling. And she had professionally been a teacher of shorthand typewriting in the business school in St. Louis. And as I remembered her, she had never really made a speech in that course. But she sat there taking notes, and the amazing thing happened that summer her husband passed on. And the next thing I knew, she'd announced herself as a candidate for his position in the House of Representatives, and I saw her flyer advertising herself, and at the end of it, it said she'd had a course in public speaking in Washington, and that was another one of her qualifications. Well, lo and behold, she had 7 competitors, but she got elected and has been in the House of Representatives until this very last year. I think she did not get elected this last time, but she has been a tremendous factor in the House on consumer issues she took up and did a great job. I never dreamed that Eleanor Sullivan had it in her to do so much. Mrs. Key from West Virginia was another woman whose husband died, and she got elected and was there a long time. At that time, and still is so, most of the wives that, most of the people, women that get in there are often wives, like Margaret Chase of Maine, who became a senator too. And they seem to get in there better than just a woman on their own, although I think that's changing. But those two women especially did a stunning job. And I remember Mrs. Key took up the idea of having a TV show once a week in her state that all the TV stations carried, and that was a report on what was going on in Washington. She did a wonderful job on that. So
after your first class that you started, for the most part, the classes thereafter, people like groups like the Congressional Club and the Democratic Club
and
the
Republican
invite you to hold classes. You weren't having a continuous class that you would put on and hope people would come to. You would be invited to do a class.
No, I never ran a continuous class right through the winter. I ran just a class of 8 or always 8 lessons. And then it ended, and then we'd have another one. I had one for the Junior League, for instance, and I had one for the Republican Women's Club. I think I had 2 in that Republican Women's Club.
But they would approach you to do the class.
Yes, they would. They'd ask me to put on the class. And then finally, after a couple of years or so, I began teaching at the Georgetown Visitation Convent, and I taught there 9 years. The girls in the high school of that convent and the girls in the junior college of the convent. And I loved that because although I was the only Protestant, I think, that ever taught at that convent, it was the first convent in America to teach women, the first school in America.
Now, was that the 8-week class or was that
That was a whole semester. That was the whole year class. And they were located out in Georgetown, had this beautiful and a well-established convent. And I had great encouragement from the nuns over the teaching that was done there. And quite a number of those students I've had since, a letter from Mother Margaret Mary about one of those students who married a congressman from Maryland. And she was lecturing all over them. And Sister Margaret Mary felt that that would have been impossible if she hadn't had that class. So she was very pleased with it. So in the end, I had all kinds of classes with all kinds of groups, but they were limited in number. They didn't go right on through the year. The teaching didn't. Most of the time I had those classes in ballrooms in the various hotels that were available.
But you now saw this very definitely as your career now.
Oh, yes. Well, I had, of course, before that been I'd been an advocate up at the Congress, a lobbyist, but as soon as I got into this teaching, I seemed to have great success with it, and I loved doing it. Of course, I could ran my classes in the morning by lunchtime or soon after I was back home, so it coincided well with my household duties to
now,
do this.
Did your children come back to Washington right after you finished at school there?
Well, no, yes. When we, as you know, when we, my husband lost his job in New England and we had to go back to Washington and start all over again and live in a boarding house, the first few classes I had there were we were still in the boarding house, and then I started back to school at George Washington University. And after I had taken every course I could there, my professor, Yeager, who was my very great speech teacher, one of the greatest there is in this country, advised me not to get a doctorate degree, but go into the women's movement where leadership was developing. And so after I got practically, I didn't actually write the thesis for the master's degree, but I practically had it and had very high marks from him as a student there. And so very soon these classes started. The first class we had was in the studio of Mrs. Madeira, Flora Medill Kiefer, who was the contralto singer of the Christian Science Church, and she gave us her studio to start. And four or five of the very well-known women were in that first class. And then I gave the speech at the Congressional Club about going to the Court of St. James and immediately started those classes. And so for the next, from 1939 to 1950, I was teaching all sorts of classes during the day and at night of all types of people. It became one of the social features of Washington, those public speaking classes. And it was a woman that offered to help me and said that this was so interesting that it should become a social must in Washington. And that's what happened. It did.
Now, when did you decide, what made you decide to write the book?
Well, very soon after I started teaching these classes, I felt a drastic need of a textbook. And so I went to one of the annual meetings of the Speech Association of America that was meeting at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. And there I found Brigance, who had founded that Speech Association of America. He had written many books on speech. He was the highest paid professor, Brigance. He was the highest paid speech teacher of America, taught at Wabash College, and was president of the Speech Association of America. So I accosted him at one of their annual meetings and said, where could we find a suitable speech book for these women's classes? That most of them were not suitable, most of the men's books that they used in the colleges were too intellectual and too biased from the man's point of view, and they were not good books for women. And he said, well, Mrs. Butler, why don't you write the book for yourself? I never felt such a cold chill of fear in all my life. The idea of sitting down and writing a book, and I said, how could I do it? And he said, write down what you've been teaching exactly as you are teaching it. And he said that such a book is very much needed for women, and you ought to write a book that slanted toward the women's use, where they need them, many things they need in that book that the men don't need. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a deadline of June 1st. And this was in the middle of the winter. June 1st, I want the first three chapters of that book.
Now, what year was that?
Well, it must have been, the book was published in 46, so it must have been about 44 or 43. And, well, all anyone has to do with me is give me a deadline, and I'm sunk. I'll do anything to meet that deadline. I don't know why. I just can't miss a deadline. And so the following summer, we retired to our hideout up in the Shenandoah Mountains, and I took my typewriter along. We retired up there the first of end of May, soon as school was out, and I took my typewriter along, and I knew I had to get those first three chapters done by June 1st. And I put it off every day. I kept thinking of everything I could do that would put off starting that writing, because I had never written a textbook. I didn't know how to do it. And so every day I'd say, now tomorrow I'll start, see. Then my husband would come up for the weekend, so I had a good excuse for not starting.
So you were going to stay there all summer by yourself?
Yeah, I always did stay there all summer.
Now, were your children with you?
Well, they came and went. They were older, and they did all sorts of things, as teenagers do when holidays come. And I invented all kinds of things for them to do. So some of the time they were there, and some time they weren't. And anyway, I remember well the Monday morning I got up at 7, and I said, I am starting that book today. And so I had a bedroom up in the top of the little barn when my husband, while he was away, because the air was so nice up there and the view was so nice and was cool. And I remember climbing down out of that barn and went into the kitchen, and I said, and set up my typewriter in the living room, and I just said, I have to start right away. So I went in and sat down at the typewriter, and by the time I had written one sentence, I was off with a bang. I never had to struggle again. I just wrote one sentence, and that morning at 7 I started, and I didn't stop until 1, and I had the whole first chapter done on the conquest of fear, which Professor Begantz told me no one had ever written a chapter like that. And I said, well, don't the men get scared too? Oh, yes, he said, the men get scared, but they don't admit it. They don't write down they're scared. But he said, that's a great chapter. And, of course, I'd had so many years of study in psychology in London that I felt I had a marvelous psychological background for that chapter particularly. It was the one thing my Professor Jaeger lacked. He had never studied psychology, and his oral criticisms in class were badly done. That was the only word of criticism I had for him. He could not give oral criticism at all without just hurting people's feelings so that they never came back hardly. They were so upset. And so he had to write out his criticisms. And as soon as I started writing that chapter, I found myself well qualified to go into this whole question of the conquest of fear.
Now, did you write the book that summer?
Yeah, I wrote that summer. By September, I had the whole book written. And then I had a funny thing happen. Number one, I wrote to a man in Harper's whom I had known in Boston very well. We had a little Fabian Society in Boston that I'd been secretary of. And this man was in that society, and his name at the moment slipped me. So I wrote to Harper's about this book and that I'd written it, and would they like to see it? And I had the extreme joy of having him write back at once. He wanted to see the book at once, and it was accepted at once. This is something that happens to very few people who write books, and it was heaven. Well, finally, the book was all ready to send to him, and I was up there in the Shenandoah Mountains with these hillbilly women who'd never been out of the mountains and never been to Washington. So I was in such a state of gaiety about having actually written this whole book during the summer. You can't imagine what it does for your soul to write something like that and get it out of your system. And as far as I could see, it wasn't too badly written. And so I invited these two hillbilly women, mothers of families, to come down with me to Washington, where we had our lovely home for the weekend. And I had a new Ford car, and so I loaded the women in there, and we had a whole tray of jam on the back seat that one of them had made. One of them was sitting on the front seat with me, and the other one was sitting on the back seat with the jam. And when we got to some of those great long hills from the Shenandoah Mountains, I had always locked the car and glided down so that the engine was locked up. Those Ford cars, they did that. And down we went, me and high gales, and suddenly we came to a curve, and I tried to turn the car around the curve, and of course the engine was locked. So instead of going around the curve, it jumped clear off the road down into a gully, just clear off, with the speech on the back seat, and the jam hitting the top of the car and then coming down on the woman that sat there. And by the time the car had hit the bottom of the gully that we jumped into, every tire was flat. Nobody was hurt, luckily. We were bounced a little bit, but the car, of course, was a wreck. And we were down so deep that nobody on the road could have ever seen us down there. But I was able to climb out of the car and get up onto the road and get word for help. But this was a terrible experience, and I had to get those nice farm women back to their homes instead of on down to Washington, and so they never got to Washington while we were up there because of that accident. And we got another car that you couldn't lock the engine like that. I don't know. It was everybody used to do that in those days when you could lock the engine and float down, you see. The theory was you saved gas. But that was a pretty nearly a disastrous experience for the book in the back of the car and for my two lovely hillbilly farm women. But anyway, we survived it and had to get another car, and that was that accident. It seems that when you're just about to do something that's important, if you aren't careful, something can happen to interfere with it, like the experience with Mrs. Roosevelt and now this experience with the book. But in the end, the book got published by 1946, and Mrs. Roosevelt wrote an expression of gratitude for it, and Lady Astor did a testimony that went on the back. But it didn't create a howling sensation, because everybody said that women didn't want to speak in public. They were too shy, too sweet, and they were not that aggressive. And the feeling was that this was a little bit premature. What do you call it?
Premature.
But I then went to the General Federation of Women's Clubs with the book, and that too was an interesting experience. Mrs. John L. Whitehurst was then the president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. She was a very beautiful woman, a brilliant executive, came from Baltimore. Her husband was a very well-to-do manufacturer, and So about that time, World War II was going on, and Lady Butler, whose husband was in the British Embassy, got a letter. In fact, Lady Butler herself got the letter, saying that the government of England wanted an American woman to come over and witness World War II and the way England was handling it, who would not only witness it, but be able to come back and report it. Lady Harold Butler came to me and said, what woman should she recommend? And I said, the ideal woman was Mrs. John L. Whitehurst, president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, that organization had clubs in every city in the United States, highly organized. And they also had a magazine, so that if Mrs. Whitehurst were to go to England and get that report, she'd have this nationwide magazine into which to give her verbal reports. Everybody know about it. So Harold Butler said, well, when could she meet Mrs. Whitehurst? So we had a luncheon for her at the beautiful headquarters of the General Federation of Women's Clubs on N Street, where there's a beautiful luncheon dining room there, and Lady Harold Butler came, met Mrs. Whitehurst, liked her, and I'm not too sure, but I think that Winston Churchill's airplane was sent over for her to bring her over to England. I never actually saw that airplane or anything, but it was said that's how she got over there, although it was not advertised. And so this brilliant woman and clever woman went to England as the guest from America, the woman's guest, and toured England, saw all of the military headquarters, witnessed the bombing that was going on, and had a tremendous experience, even went down and visited Lady Astor in Plymouth, where her home was, and experienced a terrible air raid that night in Plymouth while she was there. Lady Astor was then in the House of Commons. And just as she got ready to come back to America, the woman that was head of the army women in the British Army was taking her to her way back, to her boat that she was coming back on. And Mrs. Whitehurst said, what can we do, these women? And she said, well, Mrs. Whitehurst, what we need are some wedding gowns. You know, the women, they've taken down all their lace curtains. And when the women marry, who are in the army forces, the husbands want them in white, want to see them in a white wedding dress, and we're all out of curtains and anything to use. So Mrs. Whitehurst said, leave that to me, I'll take care of it. So when she got back to America, she launched a wedding gown campaign for every state in America to send a wedding gown to Washington, which in turn was to be sent to England to be rented out to the English women when they got married. And I went over to the headquarters the day that she sent off those wedding gowns. She had also given one. I think every state gave a wedding gown. They had modeled it at their spring conventions. And so the wedding gown was in a box with a picture of the model that had worn the gown, with the size that was noted on. And then one of the beauty operators of Washington contributed a silk stocking or several silk stockings and makeup for the to put in with the wedding gowns. So it was really something. And then Mrs. Roosevelt sent a wedding gown, too, and Mrs. Whitehurst sent one. And when they got to England, all the girls had to do was to send word to the headquarters of the Army facility and tell their sizes, what their sizes were, what type of wedding gown they'd like to have. And for $2, this beautiful wedding gown that the American women had bought would be sent to her, and she had to pay $2 postage, and then she had to pay to have it cleaned, and it went back, and somebody else wore the wedding gown. Well, whenever all of them wanted to wear Mrs. Roosevelt's wedding gown, but of course she was nearly 6 feet tall, and the big, so they had to be pretty big, tall girls to be able to handle her gown. But whenever anybody was married with Mrs. Roosevelt's wedding gown on, the queue of visitors outside the church went clear around the block twice, so they could be sure to see the girl come out of the church with Mrs. Roosevelt's wedding gown. And so today, probably all over England, and grandchildren and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are the photos of mother or grandmother or great-grandmother in Mrs. Roosevelt's wedding gown. It was, I think, one of the loveliest things that I have ever seen women's clubs do. And they made such a fuss over it and had such fun doing it. And it was such a total gracious thing. Well, anyway, when Mrs. Whitehurst came back from England, I think she covered practically every state convention that spring to report all the details of the things that she'd seen over there and the things that she'd done. And later on, she said, Jesse, I'm very grateful. That was you that launched that experience. You gave me the great experience of my life. So what can I do for you now? And so, of course, I said, I'd like to go to your next convention and put on a public speaking workshop early in the morning before the convention starts. To which she said, oh, Jesse, I don't think the women would come to that workshop. She said, they're all speaking now. Yes, I said, I've heard them speaking, but a lot of them could do with a little more training. So anyway, when you get to the convention, please reserve one of your hotel rooms for me. And I want to have four workshops early in the morning, because the conventions of the General Federation lasted a whole week.
How the workshops were to be every morning then?
Every morning, from the time they got there till they left. And they'd had to be at 7:45 in the morning, so people had to get up early. Well, I'll never forget, the first one was in St. Louis. And she had told me nobody'd come. And she did have a workshop for parliamentary procedure running by a woman who'd been doing this for years and years. So I was going to be in competition with this experienced teacher, you see. And I remember the morning when I got up, and I kept remembering the three people that had answered my course in Washington. And I just said, as I started down the hall, now you just be calm and don't get excited, and maybe there'll just be three people there, and then you just teach the three people, and then next year there'll be more people. But as I approached the ballroom, I heard this enormous buzz, and when I got to the door, it was jammed with people. I was so unhorsed, I took a little bit of time for me to gather myself together with my poise, my usual poise, and I started that first class.